Welcome to Canadian Defense Focus from CDR Radio, produced by Canadian Defense Review Magazine. This series of podcasts features interviews with leaders and experts in the defense industry, as well as reports and profiles on the very latest in defense technology.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the CDR Radio Podcast. I'm James Careless, Ottawa Bureau Chief with Canadian Defense Review, Canada's leading defense magazine. This time on the CDR Radio Podcast, we are conducting our annual year-end interview with Bill Blair, the Minister of National Defense. This episode is sponsored by CAE. Representing more than 75 years of industry firsts, CAE delivers the highest fidelity flight, mission, and personalized training programs powered by innovation. With cutting-edge technology and world-class training centers, CAE develops and deploys advanced training, simulation, and critical operations capabilities to ensure mission readiness and to make the world safer. CAE is the largest Canadian headquartered defense company, supporting training of all military pilots for the Canadian Armed Forces. Visit CAE's website at www.cae.com/defense-security for more. The Honorable Bill Blair is joining us to talk about the state of Canada's military, the status of our submarine procurement, and what Donald Trump's return to power will mean for Ukraine. Thank you, Minister, for speaking with us today.
It's my pleasure, James.
There have been numerous reports of the Canadian Armed Forces having serious readiness issues, both in terms of personnel and equipment. What will be done to address these problems this year?
Actually, I'm very encouraged by some of the outstanding work that has been done by the Department of National Defense and the Canadian Armed Forces in responding to those concerns. You may recall about a year ago, I very publicly expressed concern about the readiness of the Canadian Armed Forces, and particularly with the work that they had been doing in order to reconstitute their personnel shortages. We were short about 14,500 people at the time, and the planning that we were doing indicated that they needed an additional 16,000 people beyond that. But we'd gone through a period of almost 3.5 years in which they lost more people than they were able to hire. I've been very encouraged by the response to the challenge of that the Canadian Armed Forces is meeting, and they've made some really appropriate and necessary adjustments to their recruitment and hiring strategies, to building up training capabilities. And what we're seeing is a significant improvement in their ability to bring people on board. From an average of about 4,400 per year, the expectation is they'll be at 6,800 this year. And all of that work, I think, has put us on a much better path. We're also on a much better path to reconstituting their capabilities. We also, there's been acknowledgement that the state of repair for a lot of their equipment and platforms that they've been using, their vehicles, their ships, their planes, et cetera, really required significant new investment. And that work is also well underway. And then finally, even across our bases, the conditions in which our people work, the readiness of their housing, the availability of medical and childcare services, even the buildings in which they operate, they have suffered, I think, under a number of significant years in underinvestment. And we're now making those investments and improving the availability of that housing, the existing stock, as well as building new. I think we're on the right path. And let me also, not to be too optimistic here, we've still got a ton of work to do. But I'm seeing a renewed confidence within the Canadian Armed Forces. They know the job that needs to be done, and they're getting it done.
Now, where does your department stand in terms of major procurements, such as the CF-35 and the CSC? And will we see a procurement process for submarines this year?
Well, you mentioned submarines. You know, you may recall that when we introduced our new defense policy update in April of the last year, we talked about some of the things that we knew we were going to have to work on, but that we were only in a position to explore. That was in April. By July, the Prime Minister announced that we were going to acquire 12 submarines. We went from exploring them in April to July, when we made a commitment that we were going to acquire them. And in September, we went out into the marketplace with a request for information. And the Navy's been doing some great work in seeing what capabilities in production and available for us right now. I think that type of approach is both necessary and appropriate. And so that work is underway. We, of course, have the National Shipbuilding Strategy. We've started to see some real results being delivered from that. The joint support ships that are being built on the West Coast, the Arctic Offshore Patrol Vessels. We launched the sixth of ours just this week. So that's being delivered. And you mentioned the important combat support support ships, the CSCs, which we now refer to as the River-class destroyer. We've been working really closely with the yard in Irving Yard in Halifax. We're very close. And I'm hoping by the time you publish this, I'll be able to provide you some pretty good news with respect to a construction contract. But Irving's ready to go in the beginning of those, and we're hoping to get the first of those delivered by 2032, but that work has got to start very quickly, and we're ready to go forward with that contract in the very near future. With respect to the F-35s, we also are working on making sure we get the first of those delivered in 2028, but it's not just a matter of acquiring ships and planes and submarines. I also want to make the point that there's significant investment that's going to have to be made in maintaining and sustaining those new capabilities. It's going to involve, you know, we talk about the cost of these acquisitions. About 30% of those projects involves the acquisition of the new capital equipment. 70% of it is about maintaining and sustaining it. And so building and making sure that we have capacity in Canada to sustain those aircraft. And we're working with Canadian industry to be able to do that right here in Canada. We're working with our ship building industries in order to sustain the new fleet and to, frankly, to keep in afloat the Halifax class frigates, for example, while we work hard to replace them with the new River class destroyers. And so those investments, I think, are both necessary and clearly understood. I think a lot of the conversation to this point has been about how much money needs to be spent on defense, the 2% spending metric. But we're looking at how to invest that money to create capability to benefit the Canadian Armed Forces primarily, but also to benefit the Canadian economy, Canadian workers, Canadian industry. And you know, there's been a very thoughtful approach to that, and really needs us to redefine our relationship with industry in order to make that happen most effectively. But I've been very pleased with and reassured by the work that has taken place to this point.
Now, your defense strategy, Our North Strong and Free, commits to a renewed relationship with Canada's defense industry. Can you explain how your government will change its relationship with that industry?
Well, one of the first things I did when I got this job is I went to industry because I recognize defense policy, which we were in the process of renewing. Defense policy is also industrial policy. It's, of course, it's also foreign policy. And so we work very closely with Global Affairs on the foreign policy aspects of our work with industry. I went to industry and I asked them, what do you need from me in order to better support what we need to do? I want to support those workers and companies and industries, but I also need something from them. And so we talked a lot initially about what they required from us. And one of the things they said is they needed certainty and clarity about where we were going in the Canadian Armed Forces. And that's one of the important jobs we tried to accomplish through the defense policy update. And I went back to them afterwards, after we published the document, and I said, do you see your advice and your advocacy reflected in this document? And I think they very clearly acknowledged that they did. But we also talked about our procurement processes, for example. I'm a client of PSPC in the Canadian government who negotiates and engages in all of our defense contracts. We talked about the defense procurement processes and how we can make that process more efficient. And so my colleague, Minister Ducrot, has undertaken a pretty significant review of our defense procurement processes. I've also been working very closely with my other colleague, Mr. Champagne, from industry and innovation, about how we can be more supportive of industry and develop, you know, contracts with that ensures that some of our procurements are by necessity dealing with OEMs outside of Canada. But we want to make sure that there is real benefit to Canadian industry, Canadian workers, and the Canadian economy from those investments. And so that work has gone on. I also found it very useful to set a table with some of our industry CEOs and sit down with them. And this is a process that we've initiated and is ongoing, where we actually work together and to have a better understanding about what I require from industry, but what industry requires from me. And for example, we're trying to increase production of our ammunition. in Canada. We've got a number of important companies that already produce ammunition for us, but I need to significantly increase their production capacity if I'm going to be able to meet the Canadian Armed Forces requirements for battle decisive munitions from within Canadian sources. What they've said to us is that they need two things. They need investment in creating new production lines, including secure supply chains for those productions. And they also need the certainty that comes with long-term contracts. We built that into the DPU as well, so that there was money for investing in those industries, but also that we could now sit down and work with them on creating longer-term contracts. I think those things are foundational and fundamental. I don't want to be forced to go to other countries and to other manufacturers outside of Canada in order to meet our requirements. But unless we have that relationship with Canadian industry, unless we make those investments and offer those long-term contracts, we would be compelled to go elsewhere. And again, it comes back to defense spending as an investment in Canada. And not investment in our defense capabilities, which for me is my primary responsibility. But I also want to be able to assure Canadians that when we invest their hard-earned taxpayer dollars in creating capability for the Canadian Armed Forces, there's a return on that investment that also benefits Canada, benefits not just our defense capability, but it benefits our industries, our workers, and our economy. And so we're really trying to focus on that type of investment, which produces real value, not just in our ability to defend our country and defend our national interests, but also to extend our sovereignty and secure our sovereignty in many parts of the country, for example, in the high north and in the Arctic, and also to support Canadian industry and Canadian workers with the investments that we know we have to make.
So why does Our North Strong and Free place such an emphasis on the Arctic? What are the new threats that we are seeing in that region?
You know, for many years, I think Canada was able to rely on some of the finest and most beneficial geography of any country in the world. We're surrounded by three oceans, one of which was frozen for much of the year. We lived next door to, you know, a very friendly and supportive superpower. And so over the course of our entire history, most of the work in the Canadian Armed Forces has been expeditionary. We've sent our soldiers and our sailors and our airmen all around the world. And we have been there for our allies in Europe and in the Middle East and in Asia and Global South. We've been there wherever we were required and wherever we could help. But the world has changed. And what we're finding is, for example, through climate change, our country, our Arctic, is becoming far more accessible than was the case in the past. We're also seeing with new technologies, the defense capability that we once required in order to defend our country is rapidly changing with the advent of new technologies, cruise missiles, hypersonic missiles, the threat that cyber and space can potentially represent to us as well. And then thirdly, we also are seeing some very concerning actions of our potential adversaries. China and Russia in particular are attempting to extend their influence in our Arctic and to exploit the natural resources that exist there. And we have also seen the activities of some of them who are willing to use force to extend their influence and authority over areas which Canada has always prided itself as our nation. But, you know, and when I started talking about sovereignty and security in Canada, I went north. And one of the things that Northern communities, Indigenous communities, Northern governments told me is that security and sovereignty in Canada isn't about a plane going flying by over once in a while, or a plane ship going by when the ice is out. It's about infrastructure. It's about creating a sustainable, secure environment for Canada and Canadians right across the North. We also know, as I've said, through changing circumstances, that we're going to have to operate in our high North. And so I'm Canada's Minister of National Defense. My first responsibility is the defense of my country, our country. And we need to do that in partnership with the people of Canada. And we need to invest in the infrastructure that is going to make that secure environment sustainable over time. And so investing in Canada's Arctic, in our military capabilities, I think it's fundamental to our future security. But it also creates a huge opportunity because in investing in infrastructure that can be multi-use, investing in airport runways and fiber optic communications, in housing, in medical facilities, in highways, in power generation systems, those investments, which are going to be necessary to the Canadian Armed Forces, but they can benefit the people of the North as well. I think there's a real opportunity, not just in national defense, but in nation building, in the investments that we are prepared to make. And our Arctic identity, we are a northern nation. And I think for many Canadians, that is such an intrinsic part of our identity. The Canadians understood the importance of investing in our country, in our defense, in engaging with Canadians in our national interest, and also investing in our country, which would help us build a stronger country, a more resilient country, and a more defensible country. And it also is an investment that makes sense to our allies. You know, we're part of NATO, but with the advent of Sweden and Finland, for example, into NATO, we now have all of the northern Arctic nations are, with the exception of Russia, are now part of the NATO alliance. And for our responsibilities to NORAD and North American security and our relationship with the United States, those investments in protecting our continent as well as our country benefits our neighbors and our allies and right across the world, but particularly in our relationship with Canada and the United States. And so this for many reasons, makes the right sense for this is the investment that we need to make in our defense capabilities. And there are many opportunities for Canada and for Canadians in those investments, but it also helps us live up to our obligations to our allies and our neighbors in North America and around the globe.
With Donald Trump back in power, what are Ukraine's prospects for surviving the Russian invasion? And if the Americans reduce their support of Ukraine, is there anything that Canada and its NATO allies can do to fill the gap?
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge the United States has been an incredible leader in helping support Ukraine and continues to do so. Again, there are opportunities in, you know, changes in government, not just in the United States, but around the world, different perspectives and different approaches. Ultimately, the responsibility for determining the future of Ukraine is with the Ukrainian people. Canada has, from the outset, has stood by the Ukrainian people in their valiant and courageous efforts to repel the illegal invasion that Russia perpetrated upon their country coming up almost 3 years ago now. And so I want to acknowledge the United States has been an incredibly important support for Ukraine, and they have demonstrated remarkable leadership in all of the countries that we refer to as the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, which includes all of NATO, but a number of other countries as well. And the United States has demonstrated great leadership in bringing us all together. What we've seen over the last 3 years is a real commitment from all of the countries of the free world to support Ukraine's aspirations for their security and for peace in the region, and standing up and helping them support and stand up to the Russian illegal Russian invasion. I believe that we've heard discussions from America about moving towards resolution of that conflict. And as long as it engages with the Ukrainian people, then certainly we support an effort to get to the end of the hostilities. Canada will continue to support, and I believe all of our partners, including the United States, will continue to support peace and security in the region. And that may take a number of, there's some evolution in the approach, but I think ultimately we are all resolved to protect and support the people of Ukraine and to provide them with the supports that they require to work towards the end of hostilities and the security of the country.
What impact will Trump's return have on NORAD modernization?
I'm actually pretty confident it's going to accelerate it. We've heard very clearly from the new president of the United States that about his concerns with respect to the security of America, which, of course, includes all of North America and Canada. We're an important partner and have been for 74 years in protecting the North American continent. I think NORAD is one of the most enduring and effective relationships. The commander of NORAD, General Guillot, is an American general. His 2IC is a Canadian general. We work side by side and have for 74 years. We've embarked on a pretty ambitious program in partnership with the United States for what we call NORAD modernization. We committed $38.6 billion to that initiative. There's some really important work that Canada is going to take the lead on in creating greater domain awareness with Horizon radar systems in the Eastern Arctic, and including much of Northern Canada, but also, of course, including Greenland and the North Atlantic. That work is you know, we're prepared to, Canada is taking a lead in that. We're prepared to deliver on our responsibilities for that. But I believe that President Trump's focus on security and defense and his expectation that partners will step up and do their part. Canada's ready to step up and do its part, and we've got a very significant role to play. I'm very confident in the path we are on NORAD modernization. And it's not just simply over the horizon radar and polar radar systems. It's also investment in satellite technologies, investments in forward operating bases. We're making huge new investments through NORAD modernization, for example, in new airfields in Nunavik. That's going to help us be able to extend our new fighter jets into those northern reaches. So these are important investments that Canada makes. There's also, I think, that with the changing threat environment that we're facing, and I've already alluded to it, about the advent of, for example, cruise and hypersonic missiles, ballistic and intercontinental missiles. We saw how impactful that has been in Ukraine, but also in the Middle East with Iran's attacks on Israel, as an example. We know that integrated air and missile defense systems for North America, Canada and the United States have a shared responsibility to build a strong system of protection from such threats for all of North America. And through our investments in Arnold Strong and 3, our previous investments through Strong, Secure, and Engaged, and the NORAD modernization investments, Canada is quite prepared to step up and do its part in defending the continent. I think the United States concerned about their security, they don't want to have that line of defense, the 49th parallel. And so I think Canada represents a significant opportunity for the United States and an opportunity for Canada as well, because when we go to do that important work in defending North America and Canada from any potential adversarial threat, it gives us an opportunity to invest in our North and invest in our northern communities and indigenous communities, and to really help build a stronger nation for ourselves.
Finally, what are your goals for the Department of National Defense in 2025?
Very encouraged by the renewed sense of optimism, confidence, and resolve that I'm seeing from the Department of National Defense and the Canadian Armed Forces. They know they've got a big job to do. They have also been greatly encouraged. There's been a conversation in Canada about the need to invest in defense. And I think Canadians have really come to the realization that these are necessary expenditures, but they want to make sure that we do it right. So the Canadian Armed Forces and the Department of National Defense and I all take our responsibility to Canadians very seriously, that we've got to answer the call. We've got to make sure that we build a strong and resilient Canada, a defendable Canada. We've got to live up to our international obligations. To do that, we've got to make investments in our military capability. Canadians expect us to make those investments in a very responsible way. They want results. They also want to make sure that their money is spent well. And so the Canadian Armed Forces and the Department of National Defense and I recognize our responsibility to Canadians to make those investments and to deliver on our obligations, first of all, to our own country, but also to our international partners, that Canada will do its part in maintaining global peace and security for all of our partners. But we're also very mindful of our responsibility. We work first and foremost for Canadians, and that's the work that we are undertaking to do, not just this year. I think we're off to a good start, but we also acknowledge we got a ton of work to do. And we're going to do that work. We're not going to be able to get that job done without the right people. The right people with the right skill sets, the right leadership, the right resources in order to deliver for Canadians. And so there's a lot of work ahead of us, but I see the quality of leadership that exists within the Canadian Armed Forces and the Department of National Defense. And I see the support that Canadians are demonstrating for that work. It gives me great confidence that we're on the right track. We've got lots of work to do, and we're going to get the job.
Thank you, Minister, for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the latest in the CDR Radio podcast series. They are produced by Canadian Defense Review, Canada's leading defense magazine. I've been speaking with the Honorable Bill Blair, Minister of National Defense. To hear more CDR Radio podcasts, go to CanadianDefenseReview.com or find us on iTunes and Google Play under CDR Radio. This episode is sponsored by CAE. Representing more than 75 years of industry firsts, CAE delivers the highest fidelity flight, mission, and personalized training programs powered by innovation. With cutting-edge technology and world-class training centers, CAE develops and deploys advanced training, simulation, and critical operations capabilities to ensure mission readiness and to make the world safer. CAE is the largest Canadian-headquartered defense company, supporting training of all military pilots for the Canadian Armed Forces. Visit CAE's website at www.cae.com/defense-security for more information. I'm James Careless. Thank you for listening to the CDR Radio Podcast. Talk to you again next time.
Tune in next time for another Canadian Defense Focus podcast from CDR Radio.